Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, a pet wellness advocate with a special interest in dog and cat nutrition, here to help you unravel the mysteries of pet foods so you can make a thoughtful decision about feeding your own dogs and cats. This show is a production of Eight Paws LLC, with opinions and information that are the sole responsibility of the expert guests who offer them. We're helping get the word out about the catnip allergy study. Are you allergic to cats? Does your cat or the cat of a friend or family member cause you to sneeze or get itchy, watery eyes? You may be qualified to participate in catnip, a clinical study of an investigational drug combined with allergy shots. Researchers are screening cat allergic individuals at their study sites in Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, Baltimore, Chapel Hill, Seattle, and Madison. If you're allergic to cats and interested in learning more about the catnip study, go to catallergystudy.org. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Nordic Naturals, omega-3 fish oil products that provide dogs and cats with the same premium quality omega-3 fish oils as for people. Research shows that even the best diets are deficient in the essential fatty acids found in omega-3 oils. Nordic Naturals uses responsibly sourced, healthy wild fish and uses third-party testing to guarantee purity and freshness in all their oils. Hello, Dr. Sean. I have a new question today. I always have new questions for you. The DNA of different proteins in pet food. Now, I don't know. This sounds like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but there is a lot written, or some written, in blogs and on the internet and even in articles, you know, in traditional media about, oh my goodness, a pet food says it's made of lamb and somebody found the trace of DNA of chicken in there. This is terrible. They're lying. They're cheating. They're tricking you. And what if your dog's allergic to chicken? What will this do to your dog? And I just think that this is, way, from my perspective, like, really, was there a lot of chicken in there? And is it really the end of the world? And how would that happen? And does that mean something is being done wrong? Is it to save money? Did someone not clean out a machine properly? Or is this a topic that on the medical veterinary side of nutrition is something that you folks are aware of and think about or talk about? Or is this more on the consumer side?
So it's an interesting topic, and it's one that actually does have a basis in veterinary medicine because of the concern for animals who are food allergic. And, okay. And that probably is really the only place this becomes, in my mind, a real concern. So food allergic animals, even with very small exposure, they can have reactions. And so if you're buying something that's a therapeutic veterinary food, your expectation is that that food will not have cross-contamination or other antigen sources in it to the best of the ability of the company. And that typically means that the plant has been cleaned thoroughly before that particular food has been run. Whereas a lot of other foods, you know, if you're just making over-the-counter food, you go back to back to back. And unless you have some type of food safety concern where you have to do a full clean out, you might run one day,
you know,
chicken, and then you switch over and the other half of the shift, you go and you start making your beef-based product or something along those lines. And this is not something that's new. It's been a big enough concern that, for example, when we import our food into Canada, we have to prove that the facility doesn't have certain ruminant material being processed in it at any step because they're worried about and know that cross-contamination is potentially likely. So it's a known issue. I think that where the people get nervous about it is if they have a food allergic animal and they're feeding something over the counter, they don't realize that the level of cleanliness, I don't really want to use that word, but
right.
Maybe the of care is not the same. It's not that they're trying to mislead you, but you know, they're not saying, oh, we're, you know, selling a food that says it's lamb and it's all chicken. They're just saying that, yeah, you know, when we're done making some chicken food, we're going to switch over our facility and start making it lamb. And this happens in food, you know, that we buy too. You see it all the time that, you know, with food allergen warnings.
Oh, it says this is in a facility that also uses walnuts and wheat and soy. Is that
right.
Why?
That's exactly, because they're using shared equipment that is not completely necessarily cleaned off between runs. And so if they were processing something with peanuts, you know, a day before, there can be cross-contamination, and there may be enough if you test it, or for a food allergic person, enough for them to react to, because we're now talking, you know, minute amounts. And you can kind of get a sense of that. You hear these horror stories of someone who has got a peanut allergy that, you know, their significant other ate a peanut butter sandwich and, you know, an hour later
kissed
them, and then they had a horrible reaction.
About the little kid that was on an airplane and peanuts were opened and there was peanut dust in the air that he breathed in and had a terrible allergic reaction.
Right. You can imagine how little this really is as a comparison as to how much, you know, material that they're really dealing with. So I think that I don't think that there is something nefarious going on for the most part when you find this. I think that your point is how much are we talking about? Certainly there are times where people are cheating and they're using a less expensive ingredient and they're using it and claiming it to be others. That's very rare. And that's where I think people get nervous about it.
Right.
But I think from a practical perspective, what they should realize is that if they have an animal that is very food allergic, they should be using a very special food and paying the premium for it. Because I find a lot of times what people are trying to do is they have a food allergic animal, they see the options from the companies that make therapeutic pet foods, and they see the cost of it, and they think to themselves, oh, that's so much more expensive, I'll just save money and buy the product over the counter. Well, one of the reasons why that other food is so expensive is because of the extra expense and care that has been taken to make sure that there isn't cross-contamination, or that you know, they've paid for the facility and the downtime for that facility to be cleaned out before they run their special, you know, therapeutic food that is avoiding cross-contamination.
So I guess the other thing is that some people, I'm on that list, look at the deck. I love to use your words when we're talking on this show. They look at the declaration of ingredients panel on a bag of food, or maybe a can of food. I don't like what they put in most of the veterinary prescription diets. I wouldn't want that to be my dog's diet for his or her whole life. It just doesn't appeal to my IQ to think that pork fat and brewer's rice is a good diet with only a whole lot of added chemicals and minerals and vitamins for a lifetime. So if I had a dog who was, I guess, chicken allergic, that seems to be the thing that dogs are allergic to if they're allergic. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting. Most allergies are directly proportional to their common use. So if something is used widely, which chicken is, it has a much higher likelihood of having more animals that would react to it. It's not Peanuts are about the exception to this.
For humans, but not dogs, right?
For not dogs, yes. But in humans, there is something about peanuts that make them hyperallergenic, meaning they seem to make allergies more likely. We're not aware of any particular protein source or food that makes dogs more allergic. And so when you see something that they're reacting to commonly, it's because it's very commonly used in pet food. And I always go back to my first resident I trained, who was from Australia, and he had come back to do his residency after being in practice for about a decade. And he said, when he early on in his life in veterinary medicine, now this is going back probably 30 years all total, that they would never use kangaroo meat, which is still used here in the States for a novel or uncommon antigen diet,
right,
because lots of dogs in Australia would have been exposed to kangaroo meat, where at that time chicken and corn was actually pretty unusual for Australians to feed to their animals. It wasn't as commonly used in pet food. And so they could still use that as a novel antigen diet, even though in the United States people
the
often...
absolute opposite. It's really interesting. So the thing that is most prevalent is what could trigger, by constant repeated exposure to it, could trigger the allergy. But what we're talking about, when we're talking about a true peanut allergy, that not can be, but will be deadly if not treated in a human. They have to carry EpiPens and go to the ER or call 911. If a dog has a chicken allergy, which really can only be determined by one of those long food trials, you know, eliminating everything except for two ingredients, it would never be deadly, right? It would cause diarrhea. Is that the worst that would happen?
Yeah, we don't see anaphylaxis, I guess, is what you're thinking about, that I've ever seen reported. I mean, it's possible. When we were in vet school, a very, probably the most troubling video I ever saw in my entire career was seeing an animal where they induced anaphylaxis,
and
it was old. I mean, it was something that had been converted over from the film, you know, from film to video and stuff. So, and you know, it was black and white. It looked like it was from the 40s or 50s. You know, there's a little bit different
attitude
back then,
absolutely,
and attitude and stuff. But at the same time, as troubling as it was, you know, as the animal passed away very quickly, they euthanized it on the video, I believe, if I remember correctly. But it was used for decades to train veterinarians what to look for, because otherwise, how do you know?
You'd never see it, because it'd be so rare to see it.
That's a whole other topic, but it's still troubling to me to this day. But, you know, that profound, absolute, huge release of inflammatory mediators that basically kills you almost instantaneously, the type of thing that why people carry EpiPens.
Yes, yes.
Really trained, or their significant other or their parent is trained to stab them in their thigh.
Yes.
With this needle. That's the type of thing that happens so fast. We just really don't see that from food allergies, and I don't know of any reports of that. So, and that's what we worry about with peanuts, or people worry about with peanuts and stuff. But the food allergies that we usually are dealing with in veterinary medicine for dogs and cats are related to itchy skin, vomiting, diarrhea, and they can be very sick from it, and they can, you know, lose weight, and they can become life-threatening if gone long enough. But it's a chronic issue. It's not something that's
that happens instantly. So these reports are characterized as, oh my God, this could be really terrible for an allergic dog. But it's more along the lines of what you suggested earlier, which is, well, they're just trying to trick us and use cheap chicken instead of costly lamb or costly salmon. And, you know, going back to the attitudes that you've talked about before, pet food companies are not out to trick people. Well, let me just stop.
I'll say something else that I think that people don't realize is I think the biggest one that they did antigen testing. I'm not sure they did DNA testing. They found a lot of pork that wasn't reported. And pork is not an inexpensive ingredient.
No.
And so it's not, so when I see that, that tells me that's likely cross contamination. Maybe there was an antigen problem with it. That doesn't tell me someone's trying to trick them, because it's not like if I were to go and reach for ingredients, if I found a lot of reports of chicken appearing, chicken's a pretty inexpensive ingredient. It's feed conversion.
Right.
How easily it can take feed and make muscle mass out of it is very low. And you can take a broiler and make it from, you know, chick to a quote adult, or at least slaughtering age, in weeks. And so, you know, whereas you don't do that with a pig. And so if the way to think about that in some ways is to say, if you're really going to be substituting animal protein for animal protein, what you're going to try to get away with is using the least expensive ingredient and putting it in where you don't see it. And that's not what they found recently. It's more of trace amounts of, you know, things that would not necessarily be economically advantageous, other than the fact that it would be economically advantageous not to have to stop and clean your entire between products.
So many of the big companies, or I guess they're called co-packers, is it right that they do everything from the least expensive sold in a supermarket, let's say less costly, and some people would say less high quality ingredients, to a much higher quality, fancier recipe, and that could be run on the same equipment in a factory when they finish a run of 100,000 bags of product X that's going to go to the supermarket? Would they then, on the same equipment, start the next run, adjusting the recipe?
Yes and no. And what I mean by that is that sometimes you have to use specialized equipment for the formula. So there are different types of extruders. We've talked about this, I think, in the past. Basically, there are single screw extruders. They are less expensive pieces of equipment. They're older technology. There are twin screw extruders, which are more expensive piece of equipment. And now there's even what's called a thermal screw that Wenger makes, that's even more expensive. It's sold, as a side note, which is really interesting to me, largely they're making inroads because it uses less energy, and so energy is a huge cost.
A new thing we haven't even spoken about before, the cost of making pet food being partly accumulated by the cost of the energy to make it.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't get into what I'm working on often, but I'm actively always thinking in one of my projects about what effects this will have on their energy costs. And that's a real big issue.
It's a very interesting one. I mean, then it becomes a true science project.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a matter of what we used to talk about, you know, for dry foods or foods that have been drying down, who do you want to shift the energy costs to? Are you shifting it to your suppliers?
Right.
So they're providing it to you as a dry product, or are you going to be doing all the drying yourself? And who can do that most efficiently? But going back to this, so depending on what's happening and what you have to do to achieve the formula you're making, for example, or what specialized equipment, it may not all be on the same equipment, but often there is. And we saw that in the big recall in 07. There were very premium foods being made on the same cannery facility and line as much less expensive food. And what really was driving the cost and what made the food premium versus not premium was the raw materials and the formula, not necessarily the equipment it was running on. Now, there's exceptions to that, but for the most part, a lot of times you will have lower cost foods running on very similar equipment to higher cost foods, and the cost really being the raw materials that they're using to make the food.
Well, that big pet food recall, the raw ingredient, which was unbeknownst in some cases to the company who'd given recipe A to be executed, but also unbeknownst to the co-packing company, was that this product that came in from China had melamine in it.
Which, I mean, by the way, was a food grade ingredient.
Wow. So could have wound up in the human food chain easily.
That could have, did. And people don't know about this or don't hear about it. But
wow.
At the same time, there were, I don't know how many thousands of babies, but there were many hundreds of babies that either died or became very, very sick in China because they made milk formula.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, they died.
They
so
died.
That same melamine that sickened the dogs and cats in the pet food, that same false protein booster, if you will, wound up in the baby formula fed to Chinese babies.
Yes.
Wow, I didn't realize it was the exact same ingredient. Well, I'm just saying that co-packer, the place that receives these products, you've said in the past that a company needs to have confidence that the company that's making the food for them is doing their very best to make sure that what they're buying is as good quality as the dollar that they've been given to spend will buy, and certainly not that it's contaminated or in any way compromised. And yet just, I don't know, recently I said to somebody, you know, there's this food, we won't say brands because I don't want anyone to take anything as a negative. This brand that has great-looking ingredients, the food deck looks swell. Roasted quail, bison, venison, some have wild salmon, smoked salmon. But the price is at least 10, 20% less per bag. So I said to this person who was teaching tracking and does a lot of Schutzhund, I think she feeds raw, but I don't. She said, oh, I would never buy that brand because it's made by the company that did the co-packing of all the recalled food. Well, that's kind of ridiculous. I mean, it's like saying you'll never go to Philadelphia to that hotel where they had Legionnaire's disease. Well, they cleaned it up, and they didn't do it on purpose.
I mean, I make this analogy to the old Jack in the Box, and I still remember this. I don't know if you remember Jack in the Box had a big recall with E. coli.
Quite a long time ago.
We're going back 10, 20 years ago. And I remember a food safety expert. They initiated, you know, all these, you know, temperature probes and changes in their protocols and stuff. And I remember a food safety person kind of very scientifically said, well, would you eat a Jack in the Box? He goes, I'd eat a Jack in the Box now more than I would anybody else.
Yes.
Because I think the reality is everyone that works in the real world has the risks. There are risks. And sometimes when there has been a problem, that is when the most learning goes on and the most corrective action takes place. And I find it interesting sometimes when folks say, I'll never use a food from a company who had a recall, because that becomes very limiting, unfortunately. And sometimes is I see it very worrisome to me, because then it puts pressure on a company if they've never had a recall. What actions do they take if there is an issue? Because the consequence, if they do have a recall, they've pushed themselves in a place where they say that you should never feed from a company that has a recall, and then they themselves would have a recall, rather than being proactive and responsible and saying, hey, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to recall because we have the potential risk, even if no animal has been sick, which we've seen that happen of late.
Yes,
with
a lot of recalls that turn out to not even have been necessary.
Not a single animal sick, not a person affected by it at all. You know, being more proactive about it, you know, rather than the company that might not be, because they position it that, you know, any recall under any circumstances means you should never buy the food from them. And I don't like that approach.
I hate it. I think it's so wrongheaded, because it's like saying, I don't know, I'm never going to send my kid to that school because another child fell off the jungle gym, or, you know, I don't know, got a fever one day. It's goofy. It's ridiculous. Right. And these things can happen to any company anywhere. No one is setting out to cut corners and, try to not have things on the up and up.
There are going to be bad players, but they'll be found out. And I can understand someone said they keep on having recalls. They keep on having problems. Okay, well, then obviously they have not learned and they have not improved and they've got an issue, and I can see avoiding them. But, you know, there are, if you said, I'm just never going to feed anything from that company, I think that's painting with a very broad strokes. And I find it really interesting in someone who is feeding raw, because they're knowingly, the risk from someone that has had a recall, I guarantee, is much less than someone feeding a raw from.
Well, I feel bad for the companies making raw foods, because they have recalls because it's out of their control.
That's
these
right.
things
what
crop up.
What they are receiving, I think we've alluded to this, when I gave the talk last summer at the AVMA, and I asked them to invite a microbiologist or someone on that side of things, and they had another veterinarian who focuses on human foodborne illness for the CDC co-present with me. You know, I found it really very interesting to see how he presented data, how the CDC and the federal government knows, and it's acceptable, how much contaminated raw meat is coming out of, you know, slaughterhouses. It's not like if you're buying even food grade meat that you're going to go, oh, there's no bacteria. That's not.
I think
reality.
I've told you the story of how I thought, well, raw, why do I have to buy a raw frozen pet food? I mean, gosh, if I'm going to try this, you know, I like to have a little of everything in my dog's meals. I believe in a huge variety and changing all the time. I'll put in raw frozen hamburger patties, because I thought, well, frozen meat, doesn't that kill off some bad stuff? And I won't let it, get warm. Mm-hmm. So I was feeding these raw frozen hamburger patties I got from Costco, because it was really cost effective. I thought, this is a piece of cake. I just, take off a patty at a time.
And probably very palatable and enjoyed.
Oh, delightful, delicious. Thank you so much, Ma. And then I read a front page New York Times, going to a double page spread inside, about human beings, many of them, many, like not six people, a lot, dozens, I don't know what the number was, getting ill or dying from human hamburger that was cooked on a grill, and that the human beef industry, and this is a kind of an agreement, if you will, an understanding between the beef industry and the middlemen suppliers and the recipients of ground meat. Because apparently hamburger is not just a piece of chuck that's ground. Maybe your own supermarket does it. But as I understand it, many different bits of meat come into a hamburger.
It's analogous to like sausage making.
Yes, and it's not all from one place. You get X percentage of fat from this place and that place. So it comes from different supply chains, that it has been agreed that they will not be tested for salmonella or E. coli. They will not test. The only place in the country at that time was Costco. And because they had such big buying power, the suppliers were still willing to deal with them. But for the most part, they would have boycotted any smaller purveyor that wanted to test it. So there's human food that it has been agreed by an entire industry. You can't test for E. coli because it's going to be in all of it, kind of. It's just going to be there.
Right. The representative from the CDC basically showed that. They had basically prevalence. And it wasn't every piece. And there's higher incidences in certain types of meat versus poultry. Poultry seem to have the highest number, of salmonella. They've been now worried a lot more about listeria, which, used to be not really on a lot of people's radar screen. But they did a whole bunch of testing.
It used to be in like raw cheeses and stuff. I remember from my pregnancy Bible.
Yeah. Not as cooked as cheeses and cold cuts and a lot of times pregnant women were told to avoid So now there's a lot more awareness of this issue, and I find it really intriguing, because someone who says I'm going to avoid, this potential minuscule risk because they had a recall in the past, and then is feeding raw, assuming it's not high pressure processed, I just struggle with the cognitive dissonance, I guess would be the fancy way of putting that, of rationalizing that they're going to try to avoid this very minuscule risk to something that has probably a little much higher risk because of just the way food is. It has nothing to do about the raw food manufacturer at all. They could have the cleanest facility in the world, the best procedures.
It's endemic to the meat.
If the meat is coming in, there's no way around it. And it's going to be present and it's going to sit there and there's no way, unless you have a kill step of some sort, to get rid of it.
Well, I think that to me, the answer is because looking for a villain, there's some comfort to people in general to look for villains and to find a bad guy and always be able to heap scorn on the bad guy. And somehow it's almost like wearing garlic around your neck to keep away the vampires. If you can heap scorn on place A, company B, type of food C, then you're safe, see, because you have a strong opinion. And that keeps you and your pet safe because you're not going to do that one thing that illogically is probably not even the thing that would protect them. I thought about it for a little while and I thought, well, that is just utterly goofy. I didn't have the argument with her. I don't want to have arguments with anybody. But I do think that the point of this show is food for thought. And I went right on Amazon, and forgive me, independent pet retailers, I love you guys, but Amazon can pull off some prices that are, you know, just like scary great. And I bought a bunch of those different foods of roasted quail and bison and venison and lowland prairie or upland, whatever, because I looked at the food deck, and I know they can't full-on lie about that. And what was in it looked great, and my dogs do really well on it, and they like it a lot, and it was a huge savings. So in terms of, just to finish up on the DNA of different proteins, there will be the different DNA proteins in many different pet foods, and if you have a highly allergic animal, you either have to cook yourself and perhaps go to balance it to make sure it's balanced, or you can get an RX food, and part of the price that you're paying for that is this hyper cleanliness of equipment, of the ingredients, of the purity, of the lack of any contamination, because it is a prescription. It's for an animal who either is sick or could get sick. It's not for the, you know, it's not just a dalliance. It really has a function. I would love to see people somehow find a way around feeding it for life. But on the other hand, for some animals, it is a lifesaver. So, and you've made some foods with pork and lentils and very unusual ingredients, and they're not inexpensive because your ingredients are not inexpensive. But, I mean, those have a food deck that's very appealing.
Right, and I think that the key is to recognize you get what you pay for often.
Yes, that's it. Absolutely. And if you know, and you can tell both in the description of what's in it and the description of the protein and carb and calorie levels, and then how does your dog look? Or how does your kitty look? I really can say a lot, you know. The proof is in the old pudding. Dr. Yep. Sean, thank you so much. It's great to not be scared of our pet food. That's today's message. Do not be scared of your pet food, okay?
Have a great rest of your day.
Wonderful talking to you. Bye-bye. The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test to find what in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. Allergies for which Spot Platinum can make a USDA-approved serum custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at vetallergy.com. We are also supported by Meow Space, a clear ventilated enclosure that can be a one cat feeding space, a litter box station, or even a safe place to nap, designed so that only one cat with a unique access device can enter the see-through box. Meow Space is made in the USA to solve out of litter box problems and individualized feeding needs in multi-cat households. Big enough for large cats to do their business or small dogs to eat their own food in peace. Meow Space benefits the whole family because it keeps dogs and small children out of the litter box, too. Go to meowspace.biz. That's meowspace.biz to see for yourself.